and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Walter Smolarek. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, whistleblower Reality Winner agreed to a sentence today of 63 months in a federal prison on one felony count of espionage. She was accused of providing a document to the online news service, The Intercept. In contrast, Jeffrey Sterling had seven counts of espionage and received only 42 months. Winner's sentence is especially harsh, and it's a harbinger of things to come from the Trump administration. Next, the European Union withdrawal bill has formally become law in the UK following a delicate compromise between the government of Theresa May and both houses of the British Parliament. The legislation enables EU law to be transferred into UK law, and it repeals all previous laws that allowed the UK to join the EU in the first place. It's one of the final pieces of legislation necessary to implement Brexit. Then, Iranian President Hassan Rouhani promised that the government would be able to handle the economic pressure of new US sanctions a day after traders demonstrated outside Parliament to protest a sharp fall in the value of the national currency, the rial. Those sanctions are due to take effect soon. And then, have you ever been to Brooklyn Heights in Brooklyn, New York? It has a fantastic view of Lower Manhattan. One of the most imposing buildings you see is the AT&T building. It's a skyscraper, but it has no windows. Why? Well, according to The Intercept, it doubles as a secret facility for NSA. And apparently, there are other such AT&T buildings in most major American cities, including Washington. And finally, the Supreme Court yesterday ruled on two highly anticipated gerrymandering cases in North Carolina and Texas, saying that most of the controversial maps in both states will be used in the upcoming election. The ruling allows three of the four Texas districts to stand and all of the North Carolina districts. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. And now we turn to NSA whistleblower Reality Winner. Reality Winner agreed to a sentence today of 63 months in a federal prison on one felony count of espionage. She was accused of providing classified information to the online news outlet The Intercept. In contrast, Jeffrey Sterling had seven counts of espionage and received only 42 months. Winner's sentence is especially harsh, but is a harbinger of things to come from the Trump administration. We're joined from the courtroom in Augusta, Georgia by Kevin Gastala. He's the managing editor for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. Kevin, welcome back.
Thank you.
Kevin, is anybody saying or is anybody talking about why this sentence was so harsh? Reality Winner agreed to plead guilty. There was just one count. She's already been in jail for a year, a little bit more than a year, awaiting trial. So why was this sentence so tough?
I think that that's the mystery that is going to go on until we hear perhaps directly from her attorneys. And her attorneys have been extremely reluctant and refrained from speaking to the press, which tends to happen in these cases. But it is clear, obviously, that this is a extraordinary sentence that, as you're mentioning, 42 months, and then for yourself, 30 months. And the plea agreement, this is the plea agreement, 63 months is the high end of the range or exactly what they're agreeing upon. And she's already been in prison for over a year. I'm hearing that what tends to happen is that ends up as 3 days credit. So if you're in a year, do they do like a 1-to-3 day ratio for the credit? So the time's going to come off of that 63. But again, then it looks like what the Justice Department was doing is giving her an extraordinarily long amount of time in prison as part of the deal so that they could still get the standard that they normally would get from like Jeffrey Sterling had.
I have to say I'm deeply troubled by this for a whole bunch of reasons. First of all, The Intercept should be ashamed of itself. The Intercept blew her identity, and indeed she was arrested 2 hours after allegedly sending this document to The Intercept. And it's because they faxed the document back over to NSA to ask if it was a real document. And her contact information, her name and her employee number were stamped microscopically on the document. And all they had to do was, you know, look through a microscope and see that it was printed by Reality Winner. And they immediately went to the FBI and the FBI arrested her. There's another part of this sentence that puzzles me, Kevin. Maybe you can explain it. And that is that she has to forfeit permanently all of the electronics that the FBI confiscated from her home. I've never heard of that happening in any other national security case. Why did that happen?
And again, I don't know exactly why that's part of the sentence, but it does not match what I've seen in prior cases covering whether we're talking about people who were accused of hacking but disclosed information that they believed was in the public interest. Those are people like Jeremy Hammond or even Barrett Brown. Or if we're talking about whistleblowers who made disclosures to the press, like Reality or Chelsea Manning. Well, in those cases, usually everything that you own comes back to you, and it's your property after it's been gone over by prosecution and FBI agents. Then your materials come back to you. I do want to address what you said about the intercept here, because part of this process of changing the plea involves the government having to present its version of the facts of what they believe happened in the case. So they did have to call Special Agent Justin Garrick to take the stand. And they did talk about the intercept, although they don't name the outlet in court. But they talked about what happened. And yeah, it is remarkable that what tipped them off to Reality Winner making this disclosure is that they were being contacted, that they learned that the intercept was contacting, as they say, another government agency. I understand that to be the NSA. And when they contacted them about the document to verify the contents of the document, then that immediately sent red flags, as you would imagine, given the insider threat programs that are in place in the U.S. government, given the whole regime of surveillance and detection systems that have been set up since President Barack Obama was in office and escalated all of these different tools so that they can go after people who make disclosures as sources to media.
And let's just, you know, to flesh out a little bit about what Reality Winner is accused of and now convicted of doing. I mean, she released basically what are assertions from the intelligence agencies about alleged Russian interference in voting machines on election day in 2016, not the underlying intelligence of it, right? So just sort of like the summary saying this is what we think happened. And then, you know, state election officials who are responsible for these things said, oh my God, we didn't notice anything like that. Can you please share with us the intelligence? And the Department of Homeland Security, I believe, I mean, initially they would actually not do that. So, I mean, all of that aside, this is really a more fundamental thing about both freedom of the press and also whistleblowers writ large. You know, the Obama administration was extremely aggressive in pursuing whistleblowers. Of course, John Kiriakou knows all about that. But that's become sort of this permanent policy. It's not really confined to one political figure or another. Even Donald Trump, who, you know, talks about whatever, you know, even he is going to be continuing this type of aggressive prosecution of people who release what's, you know, said to be classified information.
Yeah, I think it was Jeff Sessions when he took over the Justice Department. He put together a particular counterintelligence unit that could be committed to investigating leaks. And I believe he said something to the effect of he was investigating three times as many leaks as happened. He mentioned a period of time under the Obama administration that they were escalating this to a degree that was unimaginable. I think that everyone had always talked under Obama about how it was impossible to really go after every leaker because everyone is talking to the press. You can't read news organizations' reports like the Times, the New York Times, or the Washington Post without finding leaks that are printed in their pages. And yet it seems like they really are committed. And we've seen that because the most recent Espionage Act prosecution coming down the pike here is against a former a Senate committee aide, and he was an officer who was in charge of security. And he's alleged to have been talking to the press about when officials were going to testify before the committee in relation to Robert Mueller's investigation. And so that just shows you the zeal in which this president has brought to everything, all the tools, the apparatus that was already there because of Barack Obama. And I do want to say that I understand that election security people actually value what Reality Winner did, Because if, in fact, voter registration systems are vulnerable to hackers from any given country, if, in fact, something is being done in the way that the our elections at local, state, or federal level are set up, if there's something that is ongoing where they can be intruded upon, then we should be able to fix those. And that's part of why you have election integrity people who want audits and all of that, and they want to look at the machines and make sure that they're not compromised so that there isn't fraud, so that people aren't stealing the elections. It's very important what Reality Winner was concerned about. And I think she had a very good motive for why she wanted to release this document, even if at in the end, when you break down and look through it, it turns out to just be the best presumptions or assumptions of NSA officials about what may or may not have been happening during the 2016 election.
You know, that's an important point, too, because I think this is a harbinger of things to come. Jeff Sessions was bragging about this many months ago, as Kevin points out. And I think that we've got to take the man at his word. When you arrest the director of security for the Senate Intelligence Committee under suspicion of espionage for talking to his girlfriend, who happened to be a reporter, I think it was for Politico or BuzzFeed or something. I mean, that's getting pretty far down into the weeds. This is something that would have been treated 20 years ago with a harshly worded letter in your personnel file, and maybe you're not eligible for promotion for a year. Well, now it's an espionage charge with a possibility of 10 years in prison. So things have changed. And it's not getting easier for whistleblowers. And let's be clear on another point, too. Reality Winner is a whistleblower. As Kevin rightly pointed out, the information that she allegedly released was to the benefit of the American people. You know, there's a legal definition of whistleblowing. I've said it a million times. It's bringing to light any evidence of waste, fraud, abuse, illegality, or threats to the public health or public safety. And that's what she did. Kevin, we've got another minute or so to go. Tell us what else you're working on in this realm. There are so many things that appear to be pending within the Justice Department. What are you hearing?
So I think the final thing is to, again, see, I believe his last name is Wolf. I'm really interested in where this case goes, because, again, we've got Reality is the first case. You've got Terry Albury as the second case under the Espionage Act. Then you've got this third case that's unfolding now with the Senate Committee Security Officer. And it's really important here because Ollie Watkins had all of her data seized by the Justice Department. And in fact, she was also targeted by a Customs and Border Patrol officer who came to her and apparently impersonated, acted like he would be a source for her, and then turned it around and started interrogating her and wanted her to divulge how she went about finding her sources so he could use that to investigate people and uncover leakers. So I think we've got a really dark period going on right now. Unfortunately, it's a bipartisan dark era that was enabled by both Democrats and Republicans, a Democratic administration feeding into a very, very zealous and furious Donald Trump.
I think that is exactly right. We're going to leave it there. We were joined from the courtroom in Augusta, Georgia by Kevin Gastala. He's the managing editor for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
The European Union Withdrawal Bill has formally become law in the UK following a delicate compromise between the government of Theresa May and both houses of the British Parliament. The legislation enables EU law to be transferred into UK law, and it repeals all previous laws that allowed the UK to join the EU in the first place. It's one of the final pieces of legislation necessary to implement Brexit. We're joined from London by legendary anti-war activist and former British parliamentarian George Galloway. George, welcome back. George, this really was delicate. This bill was defeated a couple of times. It was defeated in the Commons in December. It was supposed to be defeated in the Lords a week or two ago. And then all of a sudden it passes. How did that happen?
Well, I think the inevitability of Brexit is dawning. The remnants of the Remain camp are still marching in their expensive shoes in some tens of thousands. But there's a sense now that the best thing for the British to do is get on with making the best of Brexit. In the end, the Conservative rebels were not prepared to bring down the Prime Minister, which would have been the only way that they could have actually stopped it. So they stepped back from the brink because, of course, they know if the Prime Minister falls, the likelihood of an early general election rises, and the possibility, some would say probability, of a left-wing Labour government led by Jeremy Corbyn would be the likely result. And so that's not a prospect many of them were prepared to entertain when it mattered.
And in fact, the BBC is saying pretty much the same thing, that this wasn't necessarily opposition, not even necessarily, this was not opposition in the Lords to Brexit, to the notion of Brexit. What it was the Lords saying that they wanted to have a meaningful say in what this legislation said in the first place. And when they got those assurances, the vote was 319 to 303, and it went to the Queen for royal assent.
Well, the protestations that people are not trying to stop Brexit, they just want to influence its shape, are usually just code for wanting so to shape it that it becomes meaningless. So they say, we accept that there's going to be a Brexit, but we want to stay in a customs union with the EU, or we want to stay in the single market, the European single market. But these effectively do wreck Brexit because they would so tie the hands of any post-Brexit government that the benefits of Brexit could not possibly be realized. So they rarely say, because it's a very undemocratic thing to say we're trying to stop a decision made by the largest number of British people who've ever voted for anything in all history. But in fact, what they're trying to do is wreck it by other means. But they've now stepped back from that brink. And so the clock is ticking to next year and our final exit from the neoliberal straitjacket that we've been in now in Britain for more than 45 years.
We're talking from London with George Galloway. He's a legendary anti-war activist and former British parliamentarian. You're listening to Loud and Clear. George, you alluded to the pretty large demonstrations that took place last Saturday in London supporting the European Union and opposing Brexit. There are a lot of people, reasons why people might oppose Brexit. I mean, some people are saying, well, this is leading to the rise of the far right and racism in society. But there are other reasons why other sections of the population oppose Brexit too. Could you characterize these Saturday demonstrations or last Saturday's demonstration? I mean, what was the class character, the political character of these mobilizations?
Well, the whiff of expensive cologne as the demonstrators went by was simply overpowering. It was virtually silent because of all the soft, expensive shoes on the feet of the demonstrators. This was a demonstration of the liberal elite and their false consciousness followers. These were people who have done well out of the last decades of neoliberal economics and austerity. These are people who profit from the cheap European labor that comes here in significant numbers, in millions. These are people who can get a Polish builder, can get a Lithuanian nanny or au pair. These are people who enjoy the espresso macchiato served by a cheap laborer from the Baltic states and so on. But for the vast majority of people in the country, especially outside of the London bubble, the last 40 years have been hell. And whilst the European Union is not the main reason for that, the neoliberalism which they enshrine is the main reason for that. And so people took the opportunity in the referendum to say, this isn't working for me. I want to try something different. And thus exiting from the European Union is necessary, but it's not sufficient. Nobody on the left has ever argued that leaving the European Union is a panacea for our people's problems. But it is necessary, even if it isn't sufficient. It won't be sufficient until we get a Labour government led by Jeremy Corbyn, taking the country in an entirely different direction. I'll give you the shorthand. Tony Blair is the man behind the demonstration last Saturday. He said the government had to take notice of what he said was 100,000 pro-EU demonstrators. But we were 2 million demonstrators against his war on Iraq, and he took no notice of us whatsoever. The hypocrisy of these people is as overwhelming as their expensive aftershave.
And, you know, there's no reason for the left to cede the position of internationalism, of international solidarity to people like Tony Blair, who, like you rightfully pointed out, is responsible for, or is in large part responsible for the Iraq war. I mean, maybe the worst crime of the 21st century. A lot of the people at the demonstration on Saturday and throughout the course of this debate over the EU withdrawal bill in Parliament, criticized Jeremy Corbyn. At the demonstration on Saturday, they were chanting, "Where's Jeremy Corbyn?" But I mean, he was in Jordan visiting Palestinian and Syrian refugees, right? I mean, being opposed to the EU withdrawal, right, even though there's people on the left who come down on both sides of those issues, you know, people who are progressive, who represent the majority of people in the UK, it's kind of false to make it this dichotomy between, you know, so-called globalism or isolationism. I mean, you don't have to make that choice.
No, there's nothing internationalist about the EU. It's a white European fortress, which lets people drown in the Mediterranean Sea if they dare to try and breach it. The overwhelming majority of people in the European Union, and thus the overwhelming majority of EU immigrants to Britain, the cheap labor that I talked about earlier, are white people. There's nothing racist about it. In fact, leaving the EU and rejoining the world is surely the ultimate act of internationalism. When we turned our backs on the former British Commonwealth, when we joined the European Union in 1973, this was the ultimate act of anti-internationalism. It was shutting out black and Asian people from our lives, from our economy, from our immigration system, and turning towards the virtually all-white continent of Europe. Europe has gone along with every war that has been unleashed by imperialism throughout that last 45 years. I've just come back from Malta, from where the destruction of Libya was mounted by the NATO and EU front just a few years ago with disastrous consequences. So there's nothing progressive about the European Union. It's a banker's ramp run by the European Central Bank on the strictest principles of austerity and of transfer of wealth from the poor and working poor into the pockets of the non-working rich.
So what comes next? We have just a little bit over a minute left. The EU withdrawal bill has now formally entered into law with royal assent. What are the key issues that still need to be hammered out in the negotiations between the UK and EU before Brexit really becomes a reality? And the deadline is next year.
The main one is the border between Britain and the European Union. At the moment, that border is on the border of the six counties of the north of Ireland with the 26 counties of the Republic of Ireland. And the complexities of that are very serious. The best way to solve them is for Britain to withdraw from the six counties and to draw a line down the middle of the Irish Sea and say, that's the border now between Britain and the European Union, and it's the border between Britain and Ireland, which should be reunited after a century of false separation.
We will leave it there. We were joined from London by legendary anti-war activist and former British parliamentarian George Galloway. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host, Walter Smolarek. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani promised that the government would be able to handle the economic pressure of new U.S. sanctions a day after traders demonstrated outside parliament to protest a sharp fall in the value of the Iranian national currency. U.S. sanctions are due to take effect very soon. We're joined from Tehran by Mohammed Marandi. He's an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature who teaches at the University of Tehran. Mohammed, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me.
Mohammed, tell us what the mood is right now in Tehran vis-a-vis these sanctions. The end of the JCPOA is actually not popular here in the United States. A majority of Americans wanted to see it remain in place. Certainly the Europeans are upset that that the U.S. has pulled out. The Iranians are as well. Tell us what people are saying in Tehran.
There is apprehension because the markets have been rattled, and the rial has devalued quite significantly. But I'm sure that the Americans and the mainstream media, every sign of discontent or dissent, they'll see it as a sign of revolution, and that's utterly misleading. I think it's quite clear that overwhelmingly the Iranians blame the United States government for this. It's creating a hostility towards the U.S. government that I don't think I've ever seen since the initial years of the revolution. And there's an extraordinarily large amount of hostility towards Trump. I think the United States is pushing Iran towards a greater convergence with rival countries like China and others like Russia. I don't think the months ahead are going to be very easy, but I do think that the devaluation of the Iranian rial is hurtful for Iranians. But personally, this is my personal opinion, it was inevitable, because what Iran and other oil-producing countries do is that they prop up the currency through the trade in oil and through the currency that they obtain through exporting oil. And what that does is that it distorts the economy, and it makes local production unsustainable, because wages go up, and the relationship between the Iranian currency and foreign currencies or other oil-producing countries, their currencies and others, they remain the same. And that makes local produced goods more expensive, and gradually it destroys the local economy. So over the last few years, because of this policy, we've seen more increasingly large numbers of factories and production companies, companies that produce goods, going bankrupt. And so this devaluation, in a sense, in my opinion, is a good thing, although it is very hurtful. If this devaluation didn't take place because of Trump, it would have actually been much more hurtful for the Iranian government, because the people would have blamed them for this situation. But now the government has the luxury of being able to blame Trump for this devaluation. So it's a hurtful process. It's not going to be easy for Iranians. But in my personal opinion is that it creates a great potential for local industries and local production.
I want to pick up on what you mentioned a couple minutes ago about these sanctions leading to greater economic cooperation between Iran and countries that are rivals of the United States. In the South Pars gas field, the Western Corporation Total was a principal stakeholder there. It seems like they're going to be leaving that project because of the reimposition of sanctions as a consequence of the United States and the Trump administration leaving the Iran nuclear deal, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. But in its place, the Chinese state-owned oil firm CNPC has pledged to step in and take over the investment that Total may be leaving behind. Now, of course, China, Russia, India, you know, these economies are sort of up and coming. They're growing very quickly. But, of course, the bulk of the world's wealth and investment capital and banking capital certainly is in the West, and countries that are likely to go along with these new sanctions. I mean, is Iran really going to be able to make up the difference by turning to these emerging economic powerhouses like China?
It's going to be a difficult transition. But I think what the Iranians will be doing is that they'll be using the Chinese, Indian, and Russian currencies, for example. And of course, there's talk of exporting oil now to South Africa. So while that will create limitations for Iran, but at least in the case of China, the market in China is so large that many of Iran's, and right at the moment, China is Iran's most important trading partner anyway. So many of Iran's needs are already being met by China. And what the Americans are doing is that they are going to intensify this relationship. So trade between Iran and China will go up. Obviously, it's going to be, there will be difficulties and there will be a transition period. But we have to remember that this is something that already happened six, seven, 8 years ago under Obama. What Trump calls brutal sanctions, and he's targeting women and children, just like he's targeting immigrants in the south of the United States. He's targeting women and children in Iran. But this is something that Obama did as well. Trump calls them brutal sanctions, and Obama called them crippling sanctions. But the objective was the same. It was to create misery among ordinary Iranians. So the Iranians have already gone through this process once under Obama. And now I think they're much better equipped to deal with it. But again, as I said, it's not going to be easy. But it's not. They do have the experience that was non-existent back then. And also, Trump has successfully antagonized so many countries that it creates a much better atmosphere for Iran to explore new paths for economic progress. But again, I don't want to minimalize the challenges that lie ahead for Iran, but I'm pretty sure that the Iranians will overcome.
Mohammed, tell us how this impacts the Iranian oil industry, whether it's the devaluation of the rial or newly imposed sanctions or reimposed sanctions by the United States.
Well, the devaluation is, I think, at the moment more psychological. And because right now Iran has no shortage of wealth that it produces from oil. And my understanding is that over the last decade, the Iranians have been accumulating a great deal of gold as well. So they don't have a shortage. A lot of it is psychological. But also, as I said before, a lot of it is because the way in which oil-producing countries use their oil wealth distorts the economy. So the Iranian rial was artificially high. And now, because of this psychological hit, it fell. But at the moment, Iran's oil industry, Iran is producing its oil more or less as usual. And the pressure from the United States will continue, and we'll have to see how it impacts Iran's oil production over the next few months. But what Trump is doing is he's also taking a big risk, because by trying to prevent Iran from being in the market, he is also creating a reliance on all the oil-producing countries. If any country has any problem, then there will be a crisis in the oil markets.
Economic destabilization is part of a pretty common playbook that the United States uses when it wants to enact regime change in a country. I think it was Henry Kissinger who talked about, you know, making the economy scream in Chile before the 1973 coup that installed the military dictatorship of Salvador Allende. And in Iran, too, there was a similar economic destabilization campaign waged prior to, you know, now the Trump administration, obviously is set on regime change in Iran. The last time the United States carried out regime change in the country, the 1953 coup against Mohammad Mossadegh. Talk about that episode in history, and if you see any parallels between the strategy back then and the strategy now.
Well, just before I get to that, one of the ironies of 1973 and the coup and when Pinochet came to power was that it was carried out on September the 11th. And I think that's very ironic, because years later we had the attacks on New York on September the 11th. And it's sort of, there's a very interesting link, the way in which the United States tries to manipulate foreign countries, and how ultimately this sort of policy, even though there's no direct link between the two, this sort of policy comes back to hit them. And in 1953, the same is true. The United States overthrew the national government of Dr. Mossadegh through a joint coup with the British government. And they, at that time, too, they tried to create immense suffering among ordinary Iranians. And they spent a lot of money on creating disturbances, especially in Tehran. They paid many thugs and groups and different people to destabilize the city to prepare the ground for the coup. And of course, again, that is one of the ironies, because Iran actually had a somewhat, rightly or wrongly, positive view of the U.S. government before 1953, because they saw the United States government as being different from the British and the traditional European colonialist powers. Again, rightly or wrongly. But what happened as a result of the coup is that the United States benefited for a couple of decades until the revolution. And as a result of the coup, I think that they've been paying they've been suffering the consequences for the last 40 years. The relationship between Iran and the United States, the very poor relationship, is the result of the coup in 1953 and 20 years of U.S. support of a very brutal dictator, 25 years of support.
We are going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Tehran by Mohammad Mirandi. He's an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature who teaches at the University of Tehran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
We're continuing our conversation on mass surveillance and an interesting article in The Intercept saying that AT&T and perhaps other telecommunications companies in the United States have been working with NSA in secret locations all around the country for many years. Walter, tell us what's new in this Intercept article. It's quite far-reaching, and it makes accusations that go well beyond what Edward Snowden ever told us.
Right. Well, this article focuses on the physical infrastructure that the NSA has set up or has access to across the country that they use to feed into this, you know, mass surveillance machine, this machinery apparatus that's able to suck up such a vast number of electronic communications all around the world, but of course that includes the United States. So, you know, these authors of this article in The Intercept, Ryan Gallagher and Henrik Moltke, they found some of these buildings. They're these large multi-story, you know, not quite skyscrapers, but kind of close to skyscrapers, located in major cities across the country. They're nondescript. They're generally windowless. I mean, it looks pretty bizarre and sort of fortress-like on the outside. These buildings are reinforced, right? They're built to withstand, you know, like military siege, you know, earthquakes. They even mentioned, you know, like bombings. These are, you know, in some respects, bomb-resistant infrastructure that holds some of what people call like the backbone of the internet, you know, the physical servers and electronic devices and other equipment that's necessary to make the internet function. So these buildings are, you know, for instance, there is one in Seattle on 1122 Third Avenue. Right here in D.C., they found one on 30 East Street Southwest. In Chicago, there's one 10 South Canal Street, San Francisco on Folsom Street. So in other words, these are sort of right in the downtown areas of some of the biggest cities across the country. And AT&T is allowing the NSA to use this physical infrastructure, to have access to this physical infrastructure in order to make their mass surveillance machine functional.
You know, when I first saw this article today, I was surprised. And then I said, no, why are you surprised? You shouldn't be surprised. The internet was invented by the Pentagon, by Pentagon scientists and engineers. It was invented in a military building in Arlington, Virginia. There's even a little historical marker outside the building on Wilson Boulevard. And it was meant to be a method of communication for the military specifically. Now, obviously, it had very far-reaching applications, and so it became what it is today. But we really ought not to forget that this was a military application in the beginning. And so this kind of cooperation between NSA, which is a component of the Defense Department, and telecommunications companies is really nothing new. I do wonder, though, why it's taken so long to go public. You would have thought that among Ed Snowden's revelations, he would have come out with something like this. Or in the Vault 7 revelations, we would have seen something like this. And we really haven't. Now, I think many of us, many Americans, have always assumed that there was some sort of cooperation between telecoms and NSA, perhaps telecoms and CIA and FBI, I don't know. But why did it take so long, do you think, for the information to come out?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, even if I don't know the specific answer to that, I mean, I can think of why it would be particularly damaging for them to for the physical locations of some of these things to be revealed, because, you know, there's certainly a lot of mass opposition to government spying. I mean, it's certainly not a popular thing, even though they try to wrap it in this veneer of national security. I mean, people are I think, outraged that their privacy rights are being violated on a systematic basis. But it's something that's kind of abstract, right? I mean, the internet is kind of, it's everywhere. It's on your electronic devices. It's this sort of nebulous thing. But now, you know, there are actual physical locations, right? This Intercept article points out a number of them, other than just NSA headquarters, which is kind of like far and not easy to get to, where that could become the magnets for protests, for people to actually like exercise their assembly rights to push back against some of this. It's also interesting, you know, considering the AT&T central role in all of this, how, like, we talk on this show a lot about the military-industrial complex, how there's a whole industry of weapons contractors, of, you know, mercenary firms, like Blackwater is probably the most infamous of them, that are addicted to war, that their whole business model is war and continued conflict and strife all around the world. But I think there's a similar model in the telecommunications industry, where they realize that their success as big monopolies, as entities that really require for them to function, require a great degree of government support. That when the NSA asks you for something like this, when the NSA asks you for help to set up the spying apparatus, you don't say no. I mean, it's really clear that there's, I mean, would you agree there's a revolving door between these big tech companies and the government?
Without a doubt. And, you know, any company, when it's approached by an intelligence service, wants to appear patriotic. And so I can't imagine anybody saying no. Anybody in any industry, you know, when you're a CEO of an American company and you're an American and the CIA or NSA or the FBI comes to you and says, your country needs you, what are you going to say? I'll do anything for my country. That's what you say. And then we end up with situations like this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it shows why whistleblowers are so important, because, you know, the government's certainly not going to willingly give up this information. These big corporations, they're all in bed together. And so I think that it's really important that we have real investigative journalism and real, you know, courageous people blowing the whistle.
Yeah, it's better that this information is out there than if it were to be still secret. We're going to have to wrap that up. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Walter Smolarek, filling in for Brian Becker.
The Supreme Court yesterday ruled on two highly anticipated gerrymandering cases in North Carolina and Texas, saying that most of the controversial maps in both states will be used in the upcoming election. The ruling allows three of the four Texas districts to stand and all of the North Carolina districts. We're joined from New York by Chris Hughes. He's a staff attorney at Fair Vote, who focuses on ranked choice voting, voter rights, and electoral reform. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Hey, Chris, explain to us how the Supreme Court came to this decision when they allowed the Pennsylvania redrawn map to stand in the upcoming election. This just seems to be a 180-degree turn away from that Pennsylvania decision.
Yeah, well, it's a good start, because Pennsylvania is actually a case that came out of the Pennsylvania Constitution and not the federal Constitution. And that's how that was the posture it was in. It came through all the Pennsylvania courts, up through the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court. And then those maps got appealed to the United States Supreme Court, who didn't intervene or didn't try and change the Pennsylvania Supreme Court's decision-making on the partisan gerrymandering claim made under the Pennsylvania Constitution. So they were saying, you know, there's nothing in the federal Constitution that requires us to step in and change that analysis. And the real difference here is in Common Cause v. Rucho, the case, the partisan gerrymandering case coming out of North Carolina, it's under the federal constitution. And like Whitford v. Gill, the Wisconsin case that came down last week, and that was essentially a punt, it's been sent back down to the lower courts, and now we're sort of stuck in this holding period waiting for at least another year at best to hopefully hear from the Supreme Court on what the federal standards for partisan gerrymandering are.
This is going to make it far more difficult, I think, for Democrats to win back the House in this election than it otherwise would have, because some of these districts, well, you know, let's look at the origin of the word gerrymandering. Elbridge Gerry was a congressman from what, Massachusetts, I guess, back in the late 1700s, early 1800s. He was an ancestor of Gary Studs, a longtime congressman from Massachusetts, and he complained about a district that had been carved out to look like a salamander. And so, because his name was Elbridge Gerry with a G, people say Jerry, and half of salamander is gerrymander, and nothing's changed over the last 240 years. So how is it that when the Supreme Court draws, let's say, mandatory minority districts, whether they're African-American or mandatory Hispanic districts, we've seen a couple in the South, that they will then let these gerrymandered districts stand when they're specifically designed to cut out minority voters?
Right. Well, that was the really challenging thing about the other case that came down yesterday, the Perez or Abbott v. Perez out of Texas, that the court suddenly seemed to be giving a lot of deference to the Texas state legislature, the people who drew the maps in this case, when they said, that they did this, they drew all these lines in good faith. And the real challenge in Abbott v. Perez is that the plaintiffs were trying to get Texas back under the Voting Rights Act, back under Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, for being so aggressive in their racial gerrymandering to cut Latino communities out of districts where they could have the power to elect a representative of their choice way back in 2011. So, you know, this plan has been wrapped up in litigation for the last 7 years, and it came down like this, and now we see that the court, on a really slim 5-4 majority, seems more interested in deferring to state legislatures than in listening to the complaints of voters in underrepresented minority communities.
Talk a little bit more about that dynamic from a historical point of view. States' rights don't necessarily have, you know, a right wing or bigoted or, you know, reactionary character to them. I mean, there are certain demands, like, for instance, the demand that free states in the North be exempt from the fugitive slave law, right? I mean, that was an example of states' rights that was progressive. But in the modern era, I mean, in recent decades, it's almost always been a negative thing for society. I would say something that goes against the expansion of rights and freedoms and liberties. Talk about that with regards to voting.
Yeah, I mean, it has been an interesting challenge because I think for the last 40 or so years, voting rights advocates could rely on the Federal Voting Rights Act, Section 5 in particular, which required states in the South and some counties in the North to get any voting law change or any change to their voting laws pre-cleared by the Department of Justice. But then, you know, 5 years ago, almost 5 years ago to the day, the Supreme Court struck Section 5 down. And so now we're seeing that the states in the South in particular feel like they have free rein to draw their districts however they want and change their election laws how they please because they aren't overseen by the Department of Justice. And we are seeing this really still a challenge with the balance of power between states and the federal government that was working relatively well before Shelby County, the Section 5 decision, but has clearly sort of continued to deteriorate in those 5 years since. And the other thing I'd add is, you know, you can look to states like California and Washington, which have their own voting rights acts, the California Voting Rights Act and the Washington Voting Rights Act, which passed earlier this year, where they go farther than the Federal Voting Rights Act to ensure that minority communities can have the power to elect candidates of their choice. But we, you know, that's rare. It's only two of these 50 states that have taken that action to better protect the interest of their minority communities. And most states we're seeing, like Texas, like North Carolina, like Virginia, continue to go beyond the bounds of what they could do under Section 5.
We're speaking with Chris Hughes from New York. Chris is a staff attorney at Fair Vote. We're talking about the Supreme Court's recent decision on gerrymandering. Chris, other than district lines being redrawn now by state legislatures, what happens next? The court cases have been heard. They've been decided. Now what?
Right. Well, so the racial gerrymandering cases, so Texas and Texas and Virginia, we are sort of stuck there. The court didn't send anything back down to lower courts. We're just we're trapped with these racial gerrymanders. But the partisan gerrymanders, we have a road ahead still. So North Carolina and Wisconsin were the two big cases this term on partisan gerrymandering, and the North Carolina plaintiffs just got sent down to the lower court yesterday. And they should know. They're hoping to get back in front of the Supreme Court to get a decision by the end of this upcoming term. So by June of 2019, they hope to have a decision from the Supreme Court letting them know what the Supreme Court actually thinks is the standard for a partisan gerrymander. They're hoping to follow the guidance given in Justice Kagan's dissent in the Wisconsin decision from last year, laying out how plaintiffs in a partisan gerrymandering case should go about showing that they're allowed to bring that case, and from there get some sort of decision on what the actual standards that the court prefers are for determining when something is a partisan gerrymander.
We're talking with Chris Hughes. He's a staff attorney at Fair Vote. Chris, in our last 2 minutes or so, I know that Fair Vote works on solutions, you know, creative outside of the box solutions for some of these, you know, these issues that we're talking about in terms of the current voting system. What are some of the solutions that you're proposing and advocating for?
Yeah, so our big proposal is this thing called the Fair Representation Act, it's HR 3057, and that is something at the congressional level that would create multi-winner ranked choice voting, which is a form of fair representation where majorities are still given the power to elect a majority of representatives, but minority communities also have the power to elect. So there's just a fair balance of power in Congress in particular, because that's what HR 3057 is focused on. But we also advocate at the local and state levels for these same kinds of reforms where majorities will win a majority of the seats on a city council, on the state legislature, but minorities can still have the power to elect candidates of their choice in those same elections, and just create a more diverse and more reflective representation of our democracy and of the people who live in the United States.
The two-party system in the United States, I mean, it's really baked into the law itself. In addition to helping address some of the racial and ethnic discrimination that goes along with gerrymandering, it seems like that system would also be a step forward in the sense of allowing a broader range of political views to be expressed as well by getting rid of this first-past-the-post system where there can only be one representative from each district based on who gets a plurality, not necessarily a majority of the vote.
Right, exactly. You know, these forms of fair representation are the biggest step you can take to making not just racially more diverse set of legislatures in the country, but also, an ideologically diverse one with multiple parties. And it's a big step, but there's also other important steps, like ensuring more people actually can vote on Election Day, doing a better job of making sure that people are registered and can surmount the various barriers we put in place to accessing the ballot. And, you know, there's other challenges like the candidate registration requirements, where they have to get, if you're in a major party, you don't really need to get all that much work done to get on the ballot, but minor parties face a lot more hurdles than major parties. Like, the Democrats and Republicans have entrenched themselves in a lot of ways, and the voting method is just one of those ways.
So, Chris, tell us a little bit more about your organization, Fair Vote. We have just under a minute left. I think a lot of people are looking at the state of politics in the U.S. and society and wanting to get involved, trying to push for changes on lots of different fronts. Tell us about Fair Vote.
Yeah, so Fair Vote, like you mentioned at the beginning, is an election reform organization. We focus in particular on ranked choice voting, this voting method that creates more fair representation for people from across our democracy. And you can go to fairvote.org and find out more about our reforms there. And you can also email the name of your state at fairvote.org to find out more about any local advocates that we have connections with in your state or your community.
Great. Well, we will leave it there. We are completely out of time. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us now on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.